Are we ready to go? Ladies and gentlemen, we'll begin the briefing here. And for those of you who were at the Lunar Science Conference last year, we plan to follow about the same sort of format. I'd like to ask each of these gentlemen to take no more than 5 minutes, if that's possible, to summarize the highlight of their presentation this morning, and then we'll take your questions. And I'll try to introduce all of these people. Most of them I know. There are a couple that I don't. To my immediate left is Anthony J. Calio, Director of Science and Applications at the Manned Spacecraft Center. Dr. Gerald J. Wasserburg, that's Wasserburg, of the California Institute of Technology. To his left is Dr. Arnold, Dr. James G. Arnold of the University. Pardon? I'm sorry about that. Dr. James R. Arnold of the University of California. To Dr. Wasserburg's left. No comment. Next is Noel Hinners of Bellcom in Washington. Dr. Paul W. Gast of the Manned Spacecraft Center. Charles Sonnet of the NASA Ames Research Center, and Dr. John A. Wood of the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge. Mr. Calio was the session chairman this morning, Tony, do you have any opening remarks, or should we go right into the papers? All right.
Next is Noel Hinners with the Geology in Context. Noel, did you want to? You were the opening speaker this morning.
You want a summary of a summary, then?
Yeah, summary of a summary.
Right. Well, I think what I've got to say is we started off with a photogeologic framework that existed before we had any missions, both either unmanned or manned. And it was obvious then there was a relative sequence of events ranging from the oldest highland regions. Then during that time and continuing through it, we had the highland basin formation, or rather the Mare basin formation, that at some time after that, the Mare underwent a period of filling, which looks by crater counts to be within a relatively narrow range. That post-Mare fill was a cratering episode extending from whenever the Mare finished filling up to the present, but such that the earlier craters, such as Eratosthenes, lost their rays, whatever caused them to lose rays, acted in that time. But the more recent craters, such as Copernicus, Tycho, are recent enough such that the process of acting did not cause them to lose their rays. The thing that was completely unknown was the absolute time scale. In other words, that could have been compressed into the first couple hundred million years or spread out uniformly over 4.6. What we have now, of course, two fantastically good peg points on the Mare fill period. Since they put the Mare filling events back around 3.5 billion years old, it means that the highland formation, the Mare basin formation, and some of the upland basin fill all had to happen in a relatively narrow time interval between 4.6 and the 3.5 billion years. Where we're still really in the dark is the actual sequence and change in cratering rate in the early days, and the span of Mare volcanism. We know there are Mare areas older than Tranquility. Fecunditatis, for instance, looks to be older, but we don't know how to calibrate the cratering scale at that end. We know there are Mare surfaces younger in terms of the relative cratering density, such as in the Marius Hills region. But again, we don't have any good calibration. All one can do is assume a linear decrease from the Apollo 12 site to the present, and you come out with something like 2.5 billion years. But as you've heard from others, it's significant on the one end what this young time scale is when the most recent volcanism occurred on the thermal, for the thermal models, and on the other end to see when these Mare floods initially started. The other thing which was
speculated upon before the missions, and which there seems to be some fairly good evidence for now, mainly from photogeologic studies, is this probable increase in the meteorite flux in the last, we'll call it some tens of millions of years, although it's very hard to put a number on when that might have occurred. So overall, it looks like there's a decreasing initial flux, probably of accreting material to form the moon, of which the Mare saw the tail end. Then some period of relatively low flux, less than we see today, and then an increasing flux, of which we are still in the midst.
Dr. Woods?
Well, geologists up to this time have studied the lunar surface rather carefully, and they have delineated areas that look different from one another, and they think they can recognize many different kinds of rock that outcrop on the moon. The Apollo flights up to date, however, have landed on only one of these types of units, namely basaltic volcanic rock that fills the maria on the moon. And we are still left in considerable uncertainty about what the rest of the moon is made of, and that is the greater and the older and therefore the most interesting part of the moon. What our group, there is a chance, nonetheless, of getting some information about the nature of the rest of the moon, because cratering events on the lunar surface tend to scatter particles all around, and there is a certain amount of debris at the Apollo 11 and 12 sites, which has, in fact, come from far away and has come from these other interesting units, and it's mixed in the soil. Our group, for one thing, has tried to estimate what proportions of the lunar soil these exotic components ought to comprise. And secondly, we have studied five soil samples that were provided to us and classified the particles and set aside the ones that we are confident are simply pieces of Mare basalt, and we've concentrated our attention on the others, the exotics. And we've identified two types of material which are exotic to the Mare landing sites and which we think are of some interest and importance. One of these that makes up the majority of the exotics is called norite, N-O-R-I-T-E, and we think that it represents the near-surface material in the ancient lunar crust that existed before the Maria were filled with basalt. It seems to be part of an ancient lunar regolith. We identified a second class of material, which is coarser-grained, shock-brecciated anorthosite, A-N-O-R-T-H-O-S-I-T-E, which we believe comes from somewhat deeper in the moon, which we think was excavated when the giant crater was blown in the moon that was to become Mare Imbrium. We think this probably came from several kilometers below the lunar surface, and that in this one case we are seeing a sample of material from the lunar interior from at least modest depth.
Dr. Guest?
I think you can see, as you hear even the five-minute summaries, that there are points where various of us agree and points where various of us disagree.
I'd like to start off where John just left off. I think if you go back to last year, there were many, many loose ends, but two interesting things that came out of the last year that were on people's minds at the end of last year's conferences. One, how can you think of the soil being 4.5 billion years old when igneous rocks, which presumably underlie it, are only 3.5 or 3.7 billion years old? That was a puzzle, which, as Dr. Rosberg said this morning, was not only a puzzle to some of you, but was a puzzle to a lot of us. And what is the role of the exotic fragments, like the anorthosites, in the soil in understanding the surface of the moon? I think we've made a great deal of progress on these particular points, and I'd like to make a few comments about them. I think in the Apollo 12 site, we now understand the differences between the exotic fragments and the local bedrock are larger, and the proportions of exotic fragments to material derived from the local bedrock are greater. That is, we have more foreign material in the soil. In some of the samples, Dr. Wood points out, it's something on the order of a half. And that result you can get either by looking at the fragments and sorting them out in little piles, or by looking at the chemistry and determining the chemistry of two N members and then making an equation that makes the N members come out to the average. The material that Dr. Wood calls norite, and which we have designated creep, creep being derived from high potassium, high rare earth element, which is a jargon that most geochemists understand, and high phosphorus, which will, I think, be elucidated in later talks on this material, are, we think, identical.
Still creep.
Creep, K-R-E-E-P. I think that when you lay his particles next to the particles that we have analyzed, you can't distinguish them. We agree with John that this may be a major material in the early lunar crust, and point out that if it is, even a material that makes up only a crust that's a few kilometers thick, it has such strange chemical properties, not strange, but it has such high concentrations of these elements in particular that I mentioned, that one must involve a major fraction of the mass of the moon in a chemical differentiation process to form such a crust. And from this, I think you can qualitatively draw the conclusion that I suggested, that the moon is a more differentiated body on a planetological scale than many people had expected, certainly than I myself had expected, a year ago. There is apparently some difference of opinion between Dr. Wasserberg and myself as to the relative roles of creep and a granitic material on the surface. I think that we'll simply debate that out. In a sense, the granitic material may just be an additional material, or the creep may be an additional material. Both of them point to the fact that the moon is very differentiated. Finally, I'd like to just jump into the end of what I said, is the mass balance type calculations that are implied by such a differentiated crust imply that the moon is not derived from average material of chondritic composition, which is interesting because we think it's the average non-volatile portion of the sun, but the building blocks that one must have in order to build planets with the chemistry of the moon must cover a much wider range of compositions than simply chondritic meteorites.
Dr. Wasserberg?
A little bit like a setup. I'd like to follow on Dr. Gass' comment. I think that the evidence was abundantly clear in Apollo 11 and is confirmed unequivocally by Apollo 12 that the moon is not chondritic in composition, which is something I guess that all of us should have known before we started if we were smart, but that's 20/20 hindsight, and that nature in some complicated wisdom has generated a variety of planets which were chemically very different relative to the nominal composition of the solar system. Now, one of our major efforts, and perhaps I'd rather like to emphasize than to go too far astray into some of the other problems, is to establish some sort of time scale for the effects and processes which happened on the moon. The moon, in contradistinction to many anticipations, was not a dead planet. Namely, it was pretty lively and it got itself all hot and bothered and partly melted. And it certainly got itself melted, and this we knew from Apollo 11, at least down to 100 kilometers depth. Now then, the questions which we have at hand are, once you get something pretty big hot, it's very hard to cool it off. And the information which the chronology tells us is twofold. First, that from the limited sites visible, there was apparently significant flooding of pre-existing basins between 3.3 and 3.7 billion years ago. But it looks like it's turned off now. So somebody backed off the heat engine, which none of us have been very clever enough to figure out how to do. Maybe Chuck Sonnet has done so by this sort of skin melting effect. In addition to this, the soil and rock 13 give us an indication of a very ancient object, namely telling us time scales getting very close to the time of formation of the solar system. The sources of the rocks which we see, namely they were dragged out of something else that was melted and squished and things taken out of them, look as if they were pointing to the time of the solar system. So a sort of compromised point of view may be limited melting of material without great fractionation of those elements which will upset the age determination apple cart, but which will in fact enrich the outer layers of the moon very greatly in the elements that Dr. Gass spoke of and that I spoke of, my colleague spoke of, particular potassium and uranium. Certainly we know that one type of rock which is being formed very early in the lunar history are granitic rocks, which we think of as rather highly evolved rocks. And these may, these can contribute and do contribute quite clearly, whether it be creep or some intermediate version in between, some really hot as a pistol radioactive material by normal comparisons in the cosmos pour in from either the highlands or from penetrations of impact into the Mare basins themselves. Extremely radioactive materials, again only by cosmic standards, which then dominate the evolution of the lunar soil as far as that time is concerned, and again point back to the magic age of 4.5 billion years.
Dr. Arnold, I think, was next.
Right. My paper was one trying to cover several fields, because in one morning you can only get so many things in. I was talking about radiation effects, which include all the kind of signals and tracers and signposts that one has from external radiation on the surface of the moon. There are three main phenomena, only one of which my own group is concerned with. One of them are these very pretty nuclear tracks, which you'll hear a dozen or more papers about at this conference. Trails like tracks in a photographic emulsion, which are left in natural minerals by very densely ionizing particles. These can tell us a good deal about a whole lot of about timescales of exposure at the lunar surface. In particular, they're very useful in getting rates of erosion. Dr. Hinnerts and was talking earlier about these rates of impact on the lunar surface. The tracks may be our best method of doing this. Interestingly enough, the main groups don't agree with each other very well about what the numbers are, but that, I guess, might make it more fun for you and us. The numbers are quite low there in the general. People are now using angstrom units per year, which translated into English units, if I can remember what an inch is anymore, would come down to a statement like this, that if we took a rock of about this size, I think I've got a model in my briefcase of the rock that we worked on, maybe trot out. And it would erode away in times of the order this big of hundreds of millions of years. Processes on the moon are very slow. The way I said that last year was that the footprints that the Apollo 11 astronauts left there would be there perhaps 10 million years before the cratering and erosion process might tend to make them invisible. Now, then there is the rare gas phenomena. Stable isotopes of various sorts, and these are used in connection with the radioactive ones in getting good firm ages for recent events like craters that throw out large piles of rock onto the lunar surface. There may be horizons becoming visible. You may be able to date individual cratering events in this way. Whether we've done it yet is, whether Marty or others have done it yet is hard to say, but this is in the works now. We know it can be done. And then finally, I talked about our own data. Our main thrust on Apollo 12 was to look at the radioactive particles produced by high-energy radiation from the sun, to get the history of the sun, really, more than to get the history of the moon. And we compared in a rock, in thin layers of a rock, these profiles for short-lived activities where we've been able to observe the sun over a few years and long-lived activities over millions of years. And to our amazement, I think this would be the right word, they are very, very similar. The reason that we are amazed is that these solar proton events are not steady things. They're maybe a couple of violent storms in a year, times like now, and then for 5 or 6 years there'll be nothing. Yet the long-term average seems to be much the same. We're checking this at various half-lives. It implies a great steadiness of the sun with respect to the high-energy radiation. We're tempted to speculate, and we yielded to this temptation, that perhaps also the main radiation of the sun, the normal heat and light that we get from the sun, are also perhaps more constant than anybody has supposed. Let me summarize that in the following way. The average of the high-energy particles, these unusual and rare things coming from the sun over a million years, is very well bracketed between the very high amounts of radiation that we saw at the time of the IGY in 1958, which was a record for all observed time, very conveniently, and the very low amounts of radiation that we had normally at the time of solar minimum in the early 60s. Perhaps if the sunlight, the heat and light, have varied as little as they varied in those 6 years over a long period of time, then perhaps we're going to have to look elsewhere for a source of the ice ages of the last million years. That doesn't look like anymore, to me, at least, terribly, terribly likely.
Dr. Sonnet was the last speaker this morning.
The basic problem, of course, is the origin of the moon, how it formed and where it formed. And in common with the planets generally, a key parameter is its thermal history and its present thermal state. In a sense, that's what all of us have been talking about this morning. And the experiment I discussed in my paper was concerned with just such a determination, a determination of a thermal profile with some side information on what the composition might be. And this was done by using a pair of magnetometers, one in orbit and one on the surface, and through a rather involved process, finding out the currents that flowed and the field that was made, and because of the currents, and in turn, what the electrical conductivity was in the interior. And from that, one infers temperature and composition, insofar as possible, consistent with what we know about these properties of rocks today. Of course, we can't go inside of the moon to look at them. That's a difficulty. As it turns out, it appears that the information permits an almost unique or unique fit to a thermal profile by a happy accident of nature, and it suggests very strongly that the interior of the moon is at a temperature something like 800 degrees centigrade, and then, of course, tapering off to the outside. The remarkable thing from the experiment is this extreme spike in the electrical conductivity in the outer part of the moon. And the region that's anomalous covers actually one-half the volume of the moon. It extends from 1,400 kilometers out to the surface. That is half the volume. The interior temperature being as low as it is strongly suggests that the radioactive content, both of fossil nuclides and the long-lived ones, the uranium, thoriums, and potassium, is quite low in the moon. The concentrations found on the surface then are gotten by the differentiation process that the geochemists have discussed. We can determine also a heat flux, which is consistent with this kind of information. And lastly, one must explain the anomaly and an explanation for it that myself I tend to prefer. If you were in the room, you might have heard a bit of controversy about it, which depends, again, on the use of the conductivity functions as we know them from the laboratory. But the model would be that the outer part of the moon was heated to melting, representing about half the volume of the moon. And the only way to do that is very early and by accretion, just the energy from the gravitational collapse. In order to do melting by that process alone, it has to happen in something like 1,000 years. Or even less than that. And at the temperature that we see today, deep in the moon, a substantial fraction of that is that primordial heat, which flowed in rather than out. Well, of course, part of it also had to flow out. Now, that still doesn't explain where the moon came from, but it's a substantial step if proven correct, because it does provide then a thermal profile and some ideas, some bounds on the radiochemistry of the body. One can make an extrapolation some 2 to 4 billion years into the future, and my prediction is that the moon will not be melted then because of the lack of the low level of long-lived radioactives, but we won't be around to find out. I'd like to just close my comments with one additional one, which you may have heard before, but I think is extremely important. It relates to the question of why we're fooling around with the moon. And it's really that the imprint of history, of solar system history, on the Earth-Moon system is centered on the moon for the first 1 billion years. It's the interesting object. The record on the Earth is wiped out in the first 1 billion years due to circumstances we're not certain of, but likely due to some dynamical connection between the Earth and moon. After that, the moon is somewhat less interesting, and the Earth becomes interesting. You really have to make a study of the binary pair in order to understand either body completely.
Okay, we're ready for your questions, and I would ask that you wait for the microphone to reach you so that we get this on the transcript. Art Hill, up here in the front.
Dr. Sonnet, I didn't quite follow you on what you think about the origin of the moon based on some of these things you were just talking about.
I hate to make a comment on that. Let me say this. I think the information that we have today, I have confidence in the information that's available today, the various people that have done experiments, is sufficient to resolve the question, but I think it will take several more years of work. The real question is whether it accreted in combination with the Earth as a dual system, or whether it was captured later by the Earth. That's the key issue. Part of that key issue may become resolved from the question of permanent magnetism. You know that there's fossil magnetism on the moon. We saw it on Apollo 12 with the magnetometer. Many of the experimenters have seen it by looking at samples directly. We think we've seen it all over the moon now with Explorer 35. I haven't recorded that, but spots of magnetism, of fossil magnetism. Now, where did that come from, you know, and when was it inserted?
Take a follow-up, then we'll go to...
I thought there was some question as to whether the magnetism found by Apollo 12 was local in character or not. You're saying it doesn't appear to be local?
The Apollo 12 measurement does appear to be local, but there seem to be many, many other cases. We found 80 cases with Explorer 35, and all the experimenters who work with samples, who work in this field, seem to have consistently found a pattern of paleomagnetism in both Apollo 11 and 12 samples, indicating that the moon was immersed in a background field of probably a few thousand gammas. The point is that there's a variation in the times of solidification from the rubidium-strontium work, and this means the field must have been around at that time. That suggests a capture, but it doesn't prove it.
Tom O'Toole.
I wonder if Dr. Wood, Dr. Wasserberg, and Dr. Gatz would address themselves to these exotic fragments into Rock 13, where they think they came from, and if any aging has been done on the fragments that your group and Dr. Wood's group picked up to correlate that with Rock 13.
Well, most of the exotic fragments that I speak of are these so-called norites, and I think they are samples of the uppermost layer of the ancient lunar crust coming from various sources physically. There are some occurrences of what is taken to be ancient lunar terra in the near vicinity of Apollo 12. And then there is a large component of debris from Copernicus, the crater Copernicus, that has been thrown to the 12 site, because the 12 site is right on one of the rays of this crater. And I think it likely that some of this norite comes from there. This is all highly speculative, of course. The other material that I mentioned, this type B breccia, I've already suggested came from somewhat deeper and maybe some of the debris that was thrown out of Mare Imbrium and what we now call the Fra Mauro Formation. And this, I suppose, will be dramatically refuted or confirmed at the Apollo 14 mission when they actually visit Fra Mauro. There's one other category that I didn't mention in the conference now. We found one fragment of a granitic material, which is similar in many ways to one of the components of Rock 13. And I suggested with as much tentativeness as possible that this might be equated with a formation on the moon called the Cayley Formation. And there are this is spelled C-A-Y-L-E-Y. And it a sizable occurrence of that formation is also in the Fra Mauro region. And this hypothesis, again, will be tested by the 14 mission. Rock 13 is an extremely messy rock. It is, as far as I can make out from the literature, a mixture of norite and noritic breccia, and the whole mess soaked in a granitic component. And as to where it comes from, since I seem to be betting on the Cayley Formation, I guess I would put it there too. I really don't know.
Attribution of these fragments to particular semi-mythical stratigraphic horizons of the moon is something which I would never concur with. I think the actual issue is that there are many rocks from different places. We damned well don't know where. Some of them may be, in fact, further down in the same section in which we sit, or transported from a variety of places. Some may very well come from the highlands, and some may have been punctured from very, very deep impacts, which went kilometers deep into the surface, and have been transported by complex impact mechanisms. I think the most important thing is not whether it agrees with someone's particular stratigraphic nomenclature, but more fundamentally, whether or not it tells us something about the different parts of the moon that we cannot afford to visit. And that, I think, is really where the money rides. Not whether it's the Cayley Formation or the lower member of something else.
Perhaps I can resolve the difference there. I think that in the two answers and in the discussion this morning, we heard essentially two possible origins, not in terms of exactly where, but possible mechanisms. One is the Copernican ray theory, which of course is attractive because we know we're on a Copernican ray, but I think one of the comments from the back of the room came, you know, that you would hear more about this later. I suspect the implication is that the turnover rate and the gardening rate in the soil is too fast that one would not expect there to be the kind of heterogeneity that you now see. That's a speculation. The second possibility is one that was mentioned by Dr. Hinners in the opening talk, and that is, and if you remember the slide about the thin layer at the top of the Hadley Rill, namely that the basalt flows, which have been sampled in the igneous rocks, may be rather thin. They may be tens of meters thick, and underneath these basalt flows, there may be an older regolith. Now, the older regolith, he suggested, might be simply chewed up older basalt. The older regolith might, however, also contain many different rock types. So as Jerry just said, it doesn't take a very big crater to go through such a young basalt flow to get into this older regolith, bring some of it to the surface. So I think there are two possible sources for these exotic fragments. And specifically answer your question, Tom, is the dating of these exotic fragments is a very interesting experiment. It's a feasible experiment. If our laboratory worked as hard and were as well equipped as Dr. Wasserberg's laboratory, we should have had the answer, but we only discovered these things 6 weeks ago, and we're a little bit less energetic, so that the answer is not in hand, but will be forthcoming. And there are other investigators who have other methods that can also work on the answer, and I should like to point out that part of the question of
that we're discussing here and a little bit disagreement on may be in fact resolved by the dating if, for example, one were able to determine a potassium-argon date that represents a time that the glass were formed, and this turned out to be a billion years or something like that, that would be a major discovery. That's pure speculation. Perhaps Jerry wants to jump on that.
No, I mean, actually, some of these things have been dated, and the techniques have been developed, and now the problem is to do them, but you're looking at a few years of work right now.
Right. Our group doesn't do ages, and anyway, the particles I'm talking about are really just marginally large enough to do anything at all with.
They're quite large enough to date, John. They're quite large enough to date. Matter of
the particles in your pictures are the kind of particles that we have analyzed completely. I mean, they're
you could date them and return 90% of them to you.
You could get a date on. I agree with Dr. Watson.
I have a question over here.
Definition of three words, please. Regolith, differentiation, and magic.
And what? Well, I'd like to crack at the magic since I invented it. The problem with the Apollo 11 dirt, which is what regolith is, it means moon dirt. I don't know why anybody invented it, but at any rate, the moon dirt, the regolith, has in this soil the peculiar property that if you look at the rocks that came back and you tried to mix them together in any proportions at all to get the dirt, you were left with the embarrassing circumstance that you couldn't get the dirt by grinding up the rocks. So you had to add something else to it. And it had to have a very magic property that you couldn't see too much of it, and it should dominate the effective age of this and certain of the chemical constituents, which are basically absent from the rocks and were abundant in the soil. This dirt, magical characteristic of the dirt, magic component, the salt that got sprayed in all over, the question was whether it was a piece of accident that at the Apollo 11 site one saw this magic, but it was not a universal magic. We know the answer is it's universal. 12 showed exactly the same thing. So somebody is sprinkling some magic material over the surface of the moon, dominating critical aspects of the chemistry and the fictive age of the regolith or dirt.
Okay, was that, Oliver, did you have one other?
I don't know if I answered that to my colleague.
Could someone comment on differentiation?
Well, differentiation is
a word commonly used by geologists, petrologists, simply as if you take one object and separate it into two objects that have different chemical compositions, that is a type of differentiation. And we're talking about differentiating a liquid into two liquids, such as the immiscible liquid that Dr. Watsonberg talked about, and separating it from the basaltic liquid. That is a type of differentiation. What I was talking on a grander scale, and that is to differentiate chemically a planet into layers of different composition, the surface being, in this case, higher in potassium, uranium, rare earths, and a number of elements like that from the average planet.
Okay, over here.
Oh, Dr. Sonnet, did you say that if the outer surface of the moon had been melted by accretion, it would have had to have been done in 1,000 years, or did I understand you correctly? Is that,
yes. If you assume a constant rate of mass infall, if you go to variable rates, it can even be less than that.
Isn't that kind of self-affirming, isn't it?
It's not as fast as some people would like. That's what a calculation gives you.
Mark Bloom, and then we'll come back up here.
There was some discussion about the ice ages. I think it was Dr. Arnold. I wonder if you could run over that again.
Well, the notion was that it means running over again. There are various ways that ice ages can come about. If you've followed this literature at all, you know there are many different theories. You have to change something because ice ages are rare in the Earth's history. They happen only occasionally. The previous period was, I think, 200 million years before that, when there had been such a period. So it isn't something that sort of naturally happens. Now, how could this come about? Some theories are internal to the Earth, or to the Earth and its atmosphere and ocean. They have to do with melting of the Arctic ice or things of that kind. There have been theories which, since the sun is the source of all the heat and light, look to the sun.
two kinds of theories, one which is associated with a Yugoslav astronomer named Milankovitch, M-I-L-A-N-K-O-V-I-T-C-H, I believe, with an experimental error, as we say, in the 1930s, who looked at the special complicated characters of the Earth's motion with respect to the Sun, the eccentricity of the orbit and the precession and all of these things, which result in the Earth getting the same amount of heat and light, but redistributing it to different parts of the Earth and to different seasons of the year. These Milankovitch changes are of the order of 1 or 2%, and they take place over tens or hundreds of thousands of years. And there's always been the possibility, which has been quite popular because it's been so no one's known anything. Always nice to have a parameter you don't know anything about, that the Sun itself might be responsible by emitting in this period substantially less light, either and heat, either as a trigger, that is something that might happen briefly, or something that might continue over a long time. And I was speculating because the chain of evidence that from our data does not permit a firm conclusion of this kind, that it appears, since the high energy stuff has varied so little, that perhaps this is a bad place to look for an explanation. Perhaps the thermal flux hasn't varied much either. I was very happy to have Tom Gold, who actually knows something about these matters, unlike myself, come up and say that seemed plausible to him too, but it should not be considered to be proven. Is that clear enough? He wants to take a crack.
I mean, the problem,
I'd like to say more directly in case you missed the messages, the problem is whether the Sun's heat just is going up and down, and these rocks monitor the particle flux, and since they don't change, then presumably this isn't changed. So that's...
Okay, we've got a question over here, and then we'll come.
Dr. Sonnet, I'd like to get back to the question of the 1,000 years. Does that tie in with Ringwood's idea of the formation of the moon?
That's right.
And do you feel that this gives support to him?
I think so. Well, at least that part of what he said.
Dr. Sonnet, if I recall, this is basically the same thermal profile you presented last year, or somebody did, and I'm asking you, has anything happened between 11 and 12 that has changed that basic profile?
Well, I didn't speak. No one from my group spoke at the last Apollo conference.
Somebody used the 800 degrees internal heat number. I recall that. I don't recall who it was.
That's another investigator using Explorer 35 data. I'd rather not comment on that.
John Wolford.
Dr. Wolfsburg, I want to get clear on the Frock 13 age. You're saying that the age is 4 billion years old, but then you're talking about some particles in it, or the granite in it is 4.5 or so? Is that how it is?
Rock 13 looks as follows. It looks as if you, say 4.6 billion years ago, you had a puddle of granite, and it sat there. And 4 billion years ago, you grabbed a piece of it and splashed it and melted it and mixed it up with some other rocks, and it crystallized again. And that would be the interpretation.
So where you stored this rock?
Yeah, I mean, the question is, this thing that I'm talking about, imagine you had a pool of granite the size of Houston, let's say, for about a scale, or maybe a thin layer that was a flow, maybe just as thick as this room, and it was melted and poured out at, say, 4.6 billion years ago. And then some later collision or heat source that we don't understand came in and squunched it, melted it out, and mixed it up with the other debris. Now, if it was a thing the size of Houston, a little bit bigger, which could be, it would have been able to melt itself then from its own internal heat sources. So sort of, it's hot enough so it could do that, and so you could, in fact, have this as a very real possibility, which was quite an inconceivable thing until we really found that planets made granites or radioactive materials so early and so segregated them.
Judd McElvain.
Dr. Wasserberg.
reminded about taking this in mind right now. This is for a television audience. Could you tell the everyday taxpayer what you found out after studying these rocks on the origin of the moon in lay terms?
Thanks, bud. I think I'd like to say it in the following way. We have, before the Apollo program, had the Earth, which is a violent planet. The average age of a rock from an Earth ocean is 100 million years old. It's very young, and the Earth is stirred up and mixed very violently. The other evidences of planetary objects in the solar system were clinkers that floated in from outer space and occasionally hit us, and they were meteorites, and we could look at them, and they were all 4.6 billion years old. Now, we know the Earth and these other objects were formed at the same time. We are sort of regenerating ourselves by remelting and volcanic processes taking place and the oceans wearing things down. The moon occupies, as Dr. Sonnet pointed out, the key in this matter because it has provided us with a planetary object which tells us something about the real evolution of planets where its history is not wiped out. So if you want to know now that what is new above what was existent before the Apollo mission, what you'd say is the following thing, that it is a typical, normal thing to expect of every dinky planet, including many of the Galilean satellites, that they went through a period of melting and differentiation early in their history, and that they are not, for the most part, fossils simply left over with the Earth segregated out as a special, lively object. I don't know if that's first cut answer to your...
So in the future flights, what do you hope to gain? I mean, you pointed it out pretty clear cut right now.
Yeah. Well,
What else do you hope to gain?
Well, what do we hope to gain is we've got a window right now between T equals zero, the beginning of the solar system, and when the Earth so totally messed up itself that we can't look at it anymore. We'd like to look in there, and that window's on the moon, and clear that the ages of the different sites are different. And the hope is to get back to the earlier parts when a planet is beginning to turn over so that we can look at, in fact, those processes which took place undoubtedly on the Earth. The arguments is, for example, as to whether a granite ever formed at the Earth a long time ago, during the early history of the Earth. It's solved now. We know the answer to that. And now the question is, what are the real mechanisms of these processes? And the second question is, did that planet shut itself off? We've got two missions and two sites. We can't answer that. By the termination of the missions, assuming we don't lose any more missions, having lost three, by the termination of those missions, we should be able to say whether or not planets have heat engines which can truncate themselves in the fashion that the moon apparently has, as distinct from the Earth, which has kept it forever.
I'd like to make one further special point, because I think that was an exceedingly important question, and I think it ought to be answered carefully. There are a number of things that are coming on the late missions besides what Jerry has already said, the special sites going into highland areas, the oldest areas, and so on. We're getting orbital science, if I can plug our own efforts a little bit, beginning on Apollo 15 and 16, and we're going to be able to map the moon and radioactivity and find out if some of these guys are right or wrong about where Apollo Rock 13 comes from. We may find the place. That's the kind of thing that can only come into the horizon now. You're getting mobility on the last three missions, which again gives us a way of exploring, being able to go miles, which we don't have now. So there's a great deal to look forward to.
Supplement what Jim said, because I really did leave it out in the following sense. The extent to which you can really learn something from deep space missions, from unmanned vehicles, is best tested on the moon. The ability to do this reconstruction, for example, in the orbital experiments, knowing what the facts are, is going to be a hell of a big payoff, because it's going to be a long time before anybody sends a man to Mars.
John Lennon.
Dr. Hinner, I think, mentioned very early on about the rate of meteoritic impact having been very high at one point and
having fallen off almost to nothing and now appearing to be on the increase. What is that relative rate of increase, and why do you think that it is increasing?
There are several lines of evidence indicating the increase. One is purely speculative, and that's the presence of the asteroids. It's pretty certain that they are indeed colliding with each other on occasion, that these collisions should generate fragmental debris. That if you started with some initial population, you start chipping away at it, you increase, at least for a time, the population of smaller objects. Now, we have an age date, that's one piece of evidence. We have an age date now on the Mare at about 3.5 billion years. If you take that age and divide by the crater density, in other words, try to extrapolate it up to today and see what kind of meteoroid flux today would have given you that crater density over 3.5 billion years, you come out with a flux two orders of magnitude lower than what you see today, kind of accounted for that crater density, say, on Procolarum. So unless there's something wrong by two orders of magnitude with the measurement of today's meteoroid flux, it has had to increase at some point within that time span between Procolarum formation and the present, with the thought being that most of it is in the near recent time rather than spread over a long period of billions of years. But I think people are thinking of the order of hundreds of millions of years for that increase.
Okay, we have time for one more question. Do we have?
A question for Dr. Sonnet. In the model that you proposed, you said that there was a basalt-like mantle. Could you say again how deep that mantle goes and what its composition is, more precisely than basalt-like, I mean, in lay terms?
I can't really be more precise than basalt-like if I want to be careful in front of my colleagues. From an electrical standpoint, using measurements made in the laboratory by Nagata and by others, it would appear to be an Apollo basalt. And 300 and down to 240 kilometers, and from 240 to 340, an additional 100 kilometers, it would appear to be transitional, because there the conductivity is no longer rising as it ought to because of increase in temperature, but rather it's falling steeply. And then in at the 340 level, kilometer level, things change completely and it begins to come up in a more gentle way. The conductivity, that is.
Thank you very much. We will have a briefing after the afternoon session, and just stay in touch with us and we'll try to let you know when and who.